couple of minutes early since we have a whole lot of material to get through. I'm Hannah. I'm a TF. Maria is going to be joining us in just a couple of minutes. She teaches section right before, I teach section right after, so we're going to keep it to the hour and a half. So as you'll see up here, we have quite a few topics we need to get through. So we'll be going a little bit fast, but if at any point we say something too quickly or you don't understand, feel free to interrupt with questions. We want to be able to make this review session as useful to all of you as possible. Awesome. So let's jump right in with some topics that we actually very, very briefly covered for the quiz zero, in the quiz zero review session. So starting with linked lists. So just make sure you have some basic knowledge about linked lists and are comfortable doing some of the basic operations. So just to review, linked lists are better than arrays because they can grow dynamically. So we have that huge advantage. We've seen them used in hash tables when we don't know exactly how many things we're going to want to insert into our data structure. Unfortunately, that we have pieces of the linked list all over memory. So we won't necessarily be able to do constantine access to any element in the linked list. In order to find a particular element, we have to iterate all the way from the beginning. So keep in mind that most of the basic operations are omega of one. So insert is just going to take one. Delete is going to take n, since we have to go find it in a given list. Find it from the list. And search could take at worst n. We can't do something like binary search on a linked list, since we can't just randomly jump to the middle. Cool. Awesome. A little bit of stacks. This, again, came up on quiz zero, so you should be super comfortable with it. But for stacks, we ask you to remember a stack of trees, and it's going to be first in, last out. So we stack things up in the stack, and then if we're trying to take something off, which we call popping off the stack, we come off the top. And if we want to put something in the stack, we call it pushing. So it's always going to be growing up from the bottom, like a stack of trees. Awesome. So if you're we've seen stacks implemented with both linked lists and arrays. If you're implementing with arrays, you want to make sure to keep track of both the size and the capacity. So size is going to be the current number of things in your linked list, in your stack, whereas capacity is the total number of things you can store in your stack. Cool? Very similarly, we have queues. In this case, instead of thinking about a stack of trays, think of a line. This is going to be first in, first out. So if you're lining up for something at the store, we hope that the person first in line is going to be helped first. Instead of saying push and pop, like we do for stack, we just say in queue and dequeue. And again, if you are implementing this with an array, we need to keep track of not only the size and capacity, but also the head, which is going to be the front of our queue. Cool. Any questions on any of that? Awesome. Moving right along. OK, hash tables. Here's where it starts to get really interesting. So a hash table is one implementation of an associative array. So basically what happens is we have all this input, and we give it to a hash function, which says, OK, this is where in the hash table it belongs. So the simplest hash function that we've seen is just saying, OK, suppose we want to put strings in our hash table. Then a really simple idea might be to say, OK, let's just sort by the first letter of the the first letter of the word. So you can see here, we take banana, we put it through our hash function, and it says, hey, that should go at index one. So we can essentially think as a hash table as a bunch of different buckets. And each of those buckets is going to hold the head of a linked list. And in that linked list is where we can actually put different pieces of data. So diving a little bit more into a hash function, here's the example I just described where we just say, OK, take the first letter of the word, and we're going to sort it into the buckets. So presumably there will be 26 buckets, one for each letter of the alphabet. Why isn't this a great hash function? What makes this non-ideal? Yeah, exactly. You're going to have collisions. So that's one thing, and we'll talk about how we can fix collisions in just a second. Another problem with this particular hash function is that our different buckets are going to be of pretty drastically different sizes. We know that, you know, there's a whole lot more words that start with A than X. So we're going to have very unbalanced buckets in our hash table. Cool. Let's get back to the point of collisions. What do we do if there's a collision? We have a couple different options. So suppose we're trying to put berry into our hash table. And we see, we want to put it in index one, but banana already lives there. What are we going to do? We have two main options. Number one is we can say, OK, there's no room in index one, but let's just keep looking through until we can find another open spot. So we'll say, OK, let's put it in spot three. Okay, that's one option, that's called linear probing. And a second option is say, okay, well, let's just make each of these buckets be heads of linked lists. And it's okay if there's more than one thing in a bucket. We're just going to append it onto the front. So here you can see, okay, when we inserted berry, we just took banana, kind of pushed it over a little bit, and threw berry in there. And that's also totally fine. This is called separate chaining. So you can think of this as kind of like an array of heads to linked lists. Awesome. Any questions on hash tables, hash functions? Awesome. Cool. Trees and tries. So a tree is any sort of data structure in which there's some sort of hierarchy or some sort of ranking to your different objects. And this will become super clear when we see an example. And we saw tries along with hash tables in PSF5, which again, totally fair game for this quiz, as another data structure that we can store different things. In the case of dictionary, we stored a bunch of words. So let's take a look at some trees. So this is an example of a tree. It has a kind of structure, a hierarchical structure, where you can see that this one node at the top has some sort of rank above 2 and 3, which are above 4, 5, and 6, and 7, which are above 8 and 9. So that's all we mean by a tree. So you can just kind of picture this in your head. Now we have a couple of more specialized trees. So one example is a binary tree. And a binary tree is, again, just going to be a data structure with some sort of hierarchy, but each of the nodes can have at most 2 children. That's where the word binary comes from. Okay? So this is an example of a binary tree. So that's a smaller category of trees. Now let's get even more specific and talk about binary trees. Binary search trees, rather. So here, the idea is not only does every node have at most 2 children, but all of the children to the left are going to be smaller, and all of the children to the right are going to be bigger. So notice in just our binary tree, there's no relationship between the numbers. But in our binary search tree, we see, okay, here's 44, and every number to the left of 44 is smaller, and everything to the right is bigger. And that holds at every level of the tree. So here, this is smaller than 22, and this is larger than 22. And that's a binary search tree. Why do we think it's called a binary search tree? What algorithm does it remind you of? Binary search, because if you're looking for a particular number in this tree, at every point you can kind of just knock off half of the tree, which is great. And so that's going to give us something that looks a lot like binary search. Any questions? All right, cool. All right, tries, everyone's favorite. So this is the example that we've seen a bunch in class. And again, this is just another way that we can store data. In the case of dictionary, again, this is just going to be strings. So let's see what this actually looks like at a slightly lower level. So let's take a look at one node in a try. And we see, okay, there's going to be a boolean and a node, a pointer to a node. And we see that the boolean is called isWord. So essentially, that's going to correspond to these little triangles, which says, if you've gotten here, you found a complete word. We know that Turing over here is a complete word, whereas just T-U-R is not a word because we don't see that little delta. And that little delta, again, corresponds to this is word, this Boolean is word. Cool? And then we have an array of children. So at each level, you have a particular node, and that node points to an array of the entire alphabet. So you can see again in this picture, I'm gonna keep jumping back and forth, that array at the top has a bunch of different nodes coming off of it. It has 26, or 27 if you wanna include like an extra character. Cool. And this gives us a way to store our data in a way that can be that you can look up super fast. What is the lookup time for a try? Yeah, in theory it's constant time. It's only going to be the size of the word that you want to look up. Even if we add a zillion more words to our try, it's not going to take us any longer to determine if a given word is in the try. So that's really nice.
Did you just initialize that array, at least a pointer to? Did you just talk about that for a second?
Sure, absolutely. Good question. The question was, we have an array that's going to have node stars as opposed to just nodes, right? Cool. So here what we're saying is our array is just going to be pointers to other arrays. Okay. So it's essentially, it kind of feels like a linked list in this way, where each of these children just point to the next node. And the way that we actually determine, hey, okay, we've iterated through an entire word, is this word in the dictionary? We just check this is word. Great question. Yeah. Sure, so the runtime for a try for lookup is going to be constant time. So it's just going to be the number of letters in the word. It's not dependent on the size of the dictionary or the size of the data structure. Awesome. So here's a slightly simpler example. In this case, you can see that the word bat is in the dictionary, and you have Zoom, but you don't have something like zoo. How would we make zoo? How would we add zoo to our dictionary? To our try? Yeah?
Make this word true for the
box. Good. So we'd say, okay, Z-O-O, and then we want to check off that box as well. Great. Alrighty. Let's compare very briefly tries versus hash tables. Tries are really great because, as we said, they provide constant time lookup, but the huge disadvantage is they're humongous. Like, you can get the sense, even by looking at it, that it's going to take up a huge amount of memory. So they're going to be much bigger than hash tables, but they're going to give us much faster lookup time. So that's kind of your trade-off, what you care about, whether it's speed or memory. Any questions on any of that? All of the C data structures? Beautiful. OK, we're going to move on to a little bit of web development with Maria.
Lovely. OK.
You can use my laptop.
Nice. Okay, cool. So as we moved on to web development, we talked a little bit about like changing permissions of files and directories so that they can be accessible to other users, to the world, and so that we can see how basically we can convey them when we develop things like websites that we've mostly been doing. So we saw the chmod command, which is change mode, basically. That's a Linux command, and it changes access permissions of file system objects. And a file system object is just a directory, a file, anything that you can change the permissions of. So to see the file permissions, we type the command ls list-l. And when we type that, we usually see some permissions that look sort of like this in front of a directory name. So D refers to directory, and then we have three triads that basically refer to the permissions of either a user, a group, or the world for the types of permissions that we can have for these three groups of people are either R for read, W for write, and X for execute, and we can have those for the group and world as well. And the tricky thing is that sometimes we type the chmod command, we would type some number that consisted of 3 bits, so we could do like 777, and that basically referred to the added value of each of these triads, because R would refer to 4, W would refer to 2, and X would refer to 1, so when added up, each of the numbers would come down to a cumulative number, to a cumulative value between 0 and 7. So you could also have 0 for no permissions at all, and that would basically give us the permissions for either the user, the group, or the world. Cool. Any questions on this so far?
You said read was 4?
Yes.
Oh,
yep.
And then by adding all those up is how you get your number.
Yeah. Cool. These are great questions. Lovely. So next, we jumped into HTML and a bit more about web development. So HTML just means hypertext markup language, and that is the markup language. This is a standard that it's used to create web pages. It's called a markup language because it's not actually compiled. It doesn't like say how some code should be executed or anything like that. It just delineates and like describes how a web page should be set up with each of its elements and how they should look to the user. So some of the HTML tags that we went over with are the following. All of our HTML documents started with a doc type HTML. Then we always have the HTML tag. We have a head and a body. It's important that HTML has this like sort of nested structure because it's very clear. And then it becomes very clear when we need to open and actually close tags. And we always need to open tags that we've opened, or close tags that we've opened. Here we have some of the tags within the head that we want to have. So we have, for example, a title of CS50. And then we actually can link a style sheet that defines how we style our website. That is CSS. We're going to go over it in the next couple of slides as well. Within the body, we set some classes and IDs. And as a reminder, again, IDs are unique, and classes can be assigned to multiple items. And that just means that we can use classes and IDs within other structures. So for example, within CSS files or style sheets to refer to specific elements and basically say that we want to style or design some element in some particular way, and we refer to them by their IDs and classes. And we can also refer to different things by tags as well. But IDs and classes just give us some versatility in what specifically we want to refer to. Cool. So just as an example, we can, again, within a CSS file where we want to define some style, so like colors, fonts, and stuff like that, we can define the style for a body. So that would define it for the whole body tag. But then we can also define the style for a hashtag title. And again, the hashtag refers to our ID, and the dot refers to our class. And then for the dot info, we can also like set some sort of attributes. And again, when we go back, we had our class called info and our ID title. And we can see that we refer to them by hashtag title and dot info.
What do you say hashtag and dot mean?
Sorry?
What do you say hashtag and dot mean?
Hashtag means ID. So hashtag title refers to the whatever elements have this ID called title. And then the dot refers to a class. So dot info refers to this element because it has the class info. Yep.
Why do you distinguish them in the HTML? Like, why do you say certain things are IDs and certain things are classes?
That's just up to you. That's a lot. Yeah.
Repeat the question.
Oh, sorry. Why do we distinguish certain elements as IDs and other elements as classes? That's just because it's a really often a design choice. It's gives you a lot of versatility and being able to say, I want this specific item to have this ID because I want to do a lot of things with it, and I only want to define a style, a certain style or a color or whatever for that item. And the way to do that is just giving it an ID. And then if I want to have a couple of different items having that, instead of like instead of doing it by tag, because the tag would like set the cell for the whole tag for every time that tag is used, you can set a class to multiple items and then just access that class and say, I want to style this class that way. So, and again, the class can be multiple different items and the ID has to be unique. Cool. Great questions. Any other questions? Okay, awesome. So again, this is how these selectors are referenced in CSS with hashtag, with dot, or without anything for assigning the style of some tag, like body. And here we have the general syntax of how this is done. Okay. To repeat some best practices for HTML and CSS, we need to, again, close all the HTML tags that we open. And what we recommended you do for and for your final projects as well as for CS50 Finance is to make sure that all of your page, like your HTML validates, and that's done with the W3 validator. And then what we did and what we recommend doing is separating styles, so CSS, from markup HTML. So anything that relates to how your page is going to visually look and how it's going to be modified should go into a CSS document, and then your markup saying how things are in relation to each other is HTML, and that should go into inside of your HTML documents. Cool. Any questions? Mm-hmm. Right. So what exactly is going on with page validation, and why do we need to do that? Basically, we need to do that because a lot of times your browser, if you don't close a tag or something like that, your browser is still going to render a page, and it might still work, but it's best practice to make sure that you've, again, closed all your tags, that all your elements are the way that they should be, and basically that it's like by the conventions that are preset. It's, again, just a thing that you should be learning to be doing as opposed to having sloppier code and stuff like that. Yep. Oh, sorry. I thought you were raising your hand. Okay. Of course. Thank you. So again, going on into how information is transferred, and communication models to transfer information, TCP/IP. TCP just means Transmission Control Protocol, and IP refers to Internet Protocol. And that just refers to the way data is delivered. And if we have some data that needs to be delivered to you, so you make a request for a certain server. So, for example, when we try to access cs50.net, we make a request to the cs50 server, and we say that we want to get this sort of information. And then we, based on this protocol for how this information is delivered, the server gives information back to us, the client, and then we're able to view the information for the page and then use it. So then Hypertext Transfer Protocol is just another protocol or a set of conventions that defines how the web browser and the web server should communicate. And putting this all together, HTTP, again, just defines how this hypertext, this defined by the HTML that we've been working it, how it should be delivered to you, and how the data that is delivered to you gets to you. And that's why, if you guys remember from class, we had a lot of like requests, and we had a lot of syntax for these requests that we're gonna go over right now. So again, when we send a request to a server, we have to define a couple of things. So we need to define the type of request that we're setting. And again, we have, for example, get is one type of method that we can have in a request. And then HTTP/1.1 is just the protocol that we're using currently. So that's most of the times that's going to be the protocol that we're using. So if you have a question like that on your quiz, that's the conventions that we have so far. Backslash refers to what sort of things we're requesting. Then our host is, for example, in this case, we're trying to like go to google.com. So this is the value for our host. So this is a type of request that could be sent, and then a type of response that could be sent, again, based on this protocol is, again, HTTP/1.1, so that's the HTTP version again. 200 OK is just the status code, and then OK is just the phrase based on that status code. And then the content type refers to the type that is returned to you that is for that web page that you receive and that your browser can render afterwards, and that is text/HTML. That's just the version of, what does 1.1 mean? That is just the version, the HTTP version of the protocol that we're using. Great question. Other questions? Okay.
Could you tell me content type real quick?
Yeah. So that is what the server, the type of information, what is content type was the question. So that's the type of information that you get back from the server, the type of data that your client, the browser, can then render that you're using. Mm-hmm.
Is that what this protocol is telling you?
Sorry?
Is that what the protocol is telling you?
The protocol.
What the content type is, or what is it?
The protocol is based on. What is the protocol telling you? That's just the way that this information was delivered to you, based on what sort of protocol was this information got like delivered back to you. Does that make sense, sort of?
So you can think of protocol kind of as a, I think Professor Milan described it in class as like kind of like a human, it's like the equivalent of human handshaking.
Yeah.
Say like, hey, I'm a request and I know how to handle HTTP of version 1.1.
Yeah.
And then the server says, oh, okay, and both exist. I also know how to deal with HTTP 1.1. And I'm going to give you back some content. In this case, it's going to be of type text/HTML.
Yeah.
So it's kind of just a way of them for communicating.
It's just confirming that you're both following the same protocol, and that both the client and the server, so the client, your browser, and the server, sort of know what you're talking about and have the convention for passing in data.
So the content type part, the top content type text/HTML, that's a separate part of the same message, or is it part of, like, say, 200? Does 200 tell them that, or is
200 says it all went okay, and then content type is sort of a separate part of the same message, and saying, and the thing that I returned has this type of text HTML. It's just giving more information. You have any of that? add? Okay. Okay. Any other questions on this? Awesome. Okay. So some other HTTP statuses that we could get, in addition to 200 okay, ones that we've like seen maybe possibly a lot are 403 and 404. So 404, if you're trying to access something that doesn't exist. So for example, in your CS50 finance PSETs, if you had been rendering quote.html and you didn't have that file, but instead you had quote.php, that would result in a 404 not found because a file might not exist. For 403 forbidden, that refers to the permissions. So if some file is not readable by the world, you might get a 403 returned. Then some other errors that you might get, 301 move permanently, 302 found, 304 modified, 400 bad requests, and then internal server error for 500 and 503 service unavailable. Cool. Yes. I would have them on your cheat sheet.
I would expect you to know what triggers each one.
Are they?
For ones that we've run into, so the question was,
Are they expected to know what each one of these status codes might be triggered by? So for the ones that we've used and ran into, I would say yes. So we've definitely seen 200 okay in lecture and in PSETs. We've seen 403, 404. For other ones?
I would say 500 seems fair game.
500, yeah.
Yeah. Just, like, have a general sense of, like, what causes them. And also, just by these names, you can kind of, like, make an educated guess as to what actually caused them. For example, move permanently, probably the file is moved permanently.
Yeah. On the previous exam, there's a 418, I'm a teapot, so how do you expect us to answer that?
That was worth 0 points. The question, 418, I'm a teapot, is technically a HTTP status, but it was worth 0 points. Obviously, you're not expected to know that.
Is that a real one?
It is a real one, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just a joke.
Yeah.
Internet people are funny.
Great questions, guys. any other questions?
What is internal server
error? Internal server error just means that you have been unable to communicate this with the server for some reason. So it's not necessarily something that has to do with the client or something like that. It's... I don't know of any specific examples that we've gone over to explain, but yeah.
Sure. So, for example, like let's say you were working on Mashup and a Google server went down for some reason, a power outage, let's say, that would be an internal server error or like some sort of like you wouldn't get a response back.
Yeah. It's just when you're unable to communicate with the server for some reason because of it going down or some other reason. Cool. So jumping into PHP. PHP, unlike HTML, is a programming language, and we started using it because it's very useful for web development. We first used it in CS50 Finance, and it basically helps us bring together this markup, the design, and how we actually use information to display things on a web page. So PHP itself means PHP Hypertext Preprocessor, so it's a recursive backronym by itself. And opening tags for PHP are the left and right arrows with the question marks in PHP. So we've already seen a bunch of it, and now we're just going to go over some of the basic things about it. So with PHP, the variable names start with dollar sign. We don't specify, again, a variable type anymore, just like we did with C. We don't need to do that. We don't have also... we can do a bunch of different stuff with variables. We can put them together by concatenating them sort of with the dot notation, which we could not do in C again. So again, we have a bit more versatility with PHP in terms of variables. Again, we don't have a main function, and PHP is interpreted as opposed to compiled. So we don't have to, just how we like did make for C files, we don't have to do that for PHP, but rather, the way that the language is written by itself, it is interpreted. And then loosely typed just means that we don't have to specify a variable type, and the variable types are sort of understood at runtime. Cool. Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by dot concatenation?
Sure. When if we want to put things together, so if we had some variable that had the value of 3 and we had another variable that had the value of string, we could put the variables together by putting a dot in between them and concatenating them. Or we could create a variable and called name and put it together by concatenating 2 strings. So if we had a string in double quotes and we put a dot after it, and then we had another string, that would create a string altogether. Was that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
When you say interpreted rather than compiled, are you talking about you don't need to be as specific when it comes to PHP versus C?
It means that when we say interpreted as opposed to compiled, what do we mean? So that means that we don't need executable files to run PHP. It means that it runs as it goes, sort of. Does that make sense? A little bit more.
So you can think of an interpreter kind of as another program that is responsible for going line by line through PHP and actually executing it, as opposed to compiling it all down to binary. It doesn't actually mean anything about like how specific we need to be. We still need to be precise and like don't forget your semicolons and make sure you have the dollar signs and things like that.
Yeah.
Good question.
Yeah. So line by line, as opposed to with C files, we have to make the whole file before we can actually run it. That's the main difference. But again, we can't really be less specific. Cool. So arrays in PHP represent actually unordered maps. So arrays associate values to keys. The two ways to declare an array based on the syntax we have, we can be more explicit in saying we have an array and we have this key 1 that maps to this value 1, key 2 that maps to value 2, or we can just create an array that contains the values itself, and then the keys are understood in a way. Cool. Any questions on this?
What would the keys be in the second example?
Like
0, 1, 2, 3?
For example, it's just the keys don't necessarily make a difference. They just like define how you can use the values inside of it. So if we had a for each loop in PHP that would allow us to go through all the values, we can go through all the values even if we had or hadn't defined a specific key within the slide's previous syntax. So even with this sort of array, we could still have a for each loop that goes through each of the values in the key, in the array. So the syntax of a for each loop, we start with an array, and this ARR variable is our actual array that we defined in the previous slide as value that literally goes through each of the values regardless of whether we had a key or not. And then we can do something with the value inside of for each loop. So again, if we had an array like this here created, so we have the key of foo and the value of bar, the key of baz and the value of qux, we can have a for each loop that goes through array as key value and then do something with the key and or value. But we don't necessarily always have to have a for each loop that goes through array as key mapped to value. We can go through the for each loop array as value.
And I think to was your question like what is the implicit index?
Kinda.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. So basically, it's going if you don't specify a key, it's going to be 0, 1.
Yeah.
Two,
yeah.
Three.
It's just like with C, it's like 0 indexed.
Yeah,
if
absolutely.
You don't specify a key. I'm so sorry. Yeah, of course. So do you want me to go over this again, or is this?
So on the previous slide, could you just go back one? Just
of course. Sorry.
So the second array here doesn't seem to have any value to key sort of association.
Right, right.
So how does that work when you say it's an ordered map? To me, that looks like a normal array to be.
Yeah. So again, this is an ordered map in the sense that there are understood, for example, the indexes here can be understood as 0, 1, 2, 3. Again, that's having those indexes is our sort of equivalent of having keys map onto values. So if our key was 0, Sorry.
No, there's chalk up here, which is actually really nice.
That's great. Okay. So, again, dollar sign array 0 would be the key for the value 1. Like, 0 would be the key for the value 1.
Sorry, it's invisible.
Okay, never mind. Chalk was a bad idea. I take it back.
Okay.
Basically, you can think of the keys as 0 maps to the value 1.
Yeah, so this is 0, this is 1, 2, 3. These can be your keys. You can think of them as... So instead of having explicit keys, they're sort of understood as being the indexes starting at 0. The chalk didn't help. Yeah. It would, yeah, it would go through each of the values. You would have to say as dollar sign and then some variable name, value. Sorry.
Sorry, I'm trying to remember. How would you do that if you're doing the automatically indexing? It's like 0.
So how would you do that if you didn't have a specific key name?
Yeah.
You would just say yourself as some name. So in your p-sets, we've noticed, you guys might remember, for each dollar sign row as dollar sign rows, we created ourselves this dollar sign rows, saying like we want to go through row as dollar sign rows, even though we didn't have this explicit dollar sign rows defined. We could just go and say this can be our key and just like go through each of the values.
So is value a new variable we're creating to store?
So it's not inherently a new variable. It's sort of a variable that refers to the value, the values inside of the array. To each of them.
It's a new variable name.
Yeah, it's a new variable name, but it's not inherently, yeah. It's just a new variable name that you can do that. So just how we did dollar sign row as dollar sign rows, rows was a new variable name that we could sort of create in our for each loop. It doesn't have to pre-exist before that. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry. Yeah, here's the example. Sure. So for each array, so that means go to this array as key value. That's going to go through this array and first go and get foo and the key foo and the value bar. And then on the second iteration of the for loop, it's going to go through and take the key baz and the value kux. And then you can do something with either of them or both of them. Mm-hmm. What is the idea of having a key pointing to value? It's just another sort of convention, another way of going through the array and being able to access either the key or the value or both and use them. Yeah.
What's the rule for the order that the for each loop runs in? So if we were to like add elements to the array later, would those be the first ones called in the for each array, or would it be later on?
So what is the order that the for each array goes the for each loop goes through an array in? It goes through the first element to the last element, to the last added element. If you add elements later on, they would be accessed. The first elements would be accessed as the first elements of the array, and then you go through each of the elements as sort of like unordered, not unordered, but the way that they have been put into the array.
So new elements are added as like the later ones, or not? So they're added like they'll be the last ones in the
loop. New elements can when new elements are added, are they added to the end of the array?
Yeah.
I believe so. Yes. And then with your for each loop, after you've added new elements and you go through them, the new elements would be accessed. The new element, if it's added last, it would be accessed last. Mm-hmm. Sure. So what we've had, can I give an example of what we would do with the value? So what you guys might be familiar with is that we've gone through an array and basically printed each of the elements, for example, as part of an unordered list or something like that. Does that make sense, or do we want to? Yeah, we could print and then basically $value, because we would be at the specific value, we would be printing the value inside of it. So if we were at our first iteration of it and we printed $value, we would be printing bar.
Are there also for loops in PHP or just for each list?
There's also for loops in PHP. Yep. And their logic is mostly the same as what you've been used to.
So is value just
fully the same? Yep. Yep, exactly. When we declare an array, we don't need to say what size it is, so we can just add elements onto it later as well. Cool. Okay. More questions? So bringing PHP and HTML together, what we have seen, for example, this example, we have an HTML form that has an input field, and the input field is just name, and then it has a submit button. And when you press the submit button in our hello.php file, we can, because the method for the form is get, we can access the whatever is at name by this get global variable that is the syntax for it is $_get, and then we can access whatever the user input inside of that form for name by specifying the name of that field. Cool. Okay. Any other questions? Or any questions on this specific example?
Where's the PHP?
Here. So this is our opening tag for the PHP.
Right.
Yes. And
the question mark equals is shorthand for just like, this is PHP
yeah.
and just echo.
Oh.
Yeah, sorry. I should have made that clear.
Echo.
Yeah.
Print.
It's just the function that allows us to print something. Great question. Okay. Awesome.
Is there going to be quite a bit of hand coding of PHP and HTML on the quiz one?
There can be a fair amount of interpretation of PHP and HTML. Not necessarily like a huge amount of coding, though. You might have to write a for each loop, though, a for loop, or any of the loops that we cover here is fair game. And that's mostly it.
I would be prepared. In the same way that we asked you to write a bunch of C functions on quiz zero, I would be prepared to do the same in PHP and JavaScript.
Yeah.
I would say a little we're not going to make you write a huge HTML page just because that's a little bit tedious.
Yeah.
But you might have parts. That's totally fair game.
Yeah.
Like small HTML page, totally fair.
How about in JavaScript as well?
Yep,
okay.
JavaScript's
fair game. That's completely fair game.
We'll get to that in 10 minutes.
Cool. SQL, structured query language. It basically allows us to manage data and in a relational database management system. That just basically means that we have somewhere to store some data that we might want to use in a website or in some other form. And then we have queries to get information from our database or to insert information in them. A lot of the common ones, update, insert, select, and delete. So for update, this is the syntax for updating data in a database. We can updating this table called table, and by saying set, we can set some values in all rows to equal something else. So we can also specify some specific entries that we want to modify, and that can be using where. And we can specify that we only want to modify some rows where the house for, if we had a table of students and all the students had a house, so we would only modify some values where a house equals career, for example. Cool. for insert, we can insert certain values into a table. So insert into table, and then the values, and then in parentheses, we specify which values you want to insert. So insert into table column 1 and column 2, the value is value 1 and value 2. So this inserts basically a new row into a table containing the values 1 and 2 under the columns 1 and 2. And then we're going to go over a quick example of how this looks like in our database in a little bit, but this final query that I think we're going to go over, select, it just allows us to select data from a table to possibly use it afterwards. And the way we do this is like we just like store it in some variable and then we can possibly use it again. So select star means select all. That's just a shorthand for selecting all from table where we are looking for some specific condition. So where column equals something, for example. If we just wanted to select all from table, this just selects all columns and all rows from a table. And then delete from table where column equals something, this just deletes some value, some row from our table where we have some specific conditions. In this case, the conditions are column equals something. So just a quick example of this, if we have this table right here and we insert it into a table, these values, that would insert a new row. And if we had auto increment, this would just like increment our ID from 0 to 1 to 2. If we selected all from students, it just returns all fields and all rows. Where year is greater than or equal to 2016, that would just return Hannah and myself. And then if we just selected year ID and year from students where the house is Cabot House, that would again return Hannah and myself. Then if we deleted from students where name is equal to Rob, that would delete the whole row. And then if we set the name, update students, set name equal to Davin where house is equal to Cabot House, that's going to go to those rows and then update the name. Cool. And then a few SQL data types are char, varchar, in and float. These are fair game. I would go over again and make sure you know and have them on your cheat sheet what each of those characters have been used for, what you use them on your p-sets, and make sure you're familiar and comfortable with having to choose from different data types in your p-set. Yes?
What was that table stored? Where is this table stored?
Well, right now it's not stored anywhere. Where is this table stored? But it can be stored in like a SQL database.
And where is a SQL database?
Like
in the computer, online somewhere, at a server?
It can be a number of different things.
We've interfaced with SQL tables mostly with phpMyAdmin. So we could ask a server to store them for us. We could store them on our own computer.
It just depends on how you want to do it for yourself. Okay. But we have been storing them, as Hannah mentioned, on phpMyAdmin, which is online. Yep. Cool. And then the way we use PHP and SQL, we stored into some variable what we've queried for. So if we select all from history where user ID equals the session ID, that would select all the rows for that person's for the specific person who is logged in from the history table and store them into rows. And a cool thing to know is the CS50's query function protects against SQL injection attacks. That just means that it makes sure the input that is entered is correct and that the person is, who is entering the input is not trying to input some malicious code to either drop our tables or delete everything inside of our database. And a quick overview of the model view controller model is it's just a way of organizing and thinking about code. It's, again, a design paradigm. What that means is that we can, and it's good practice to separate the different parts of our code and what they control into these three paradigms. So our view is most often our templates, our layout, the way that we set how our code looks. That's mostly our CSS files and anything, the way that we define the design of our code, basically. Our controller is mostly what we've been doing with PHP files. So again, working with the information that we have and defining how that information is used, and then passing that information either onto the view or the model. And the model, the way that we've been using is, has been our database, so where our information is stored so that it has somewhere to live in, and any of the code that relates to the way that we get that information or the way that we update that information. So in the MVC model, HTTP requests are sent to a web server, then the controller interprets the request from the user and then validates the user input. It's optional when that we have the controller communicate with the model, so something like our database or some other functionality that relays information. And then finally, the controller passes information onto the view so that it can be rendered and that it can become like visible to any person accessing the web page. Cool. Any questions? Awesome. So again, the model, its function again is persistent storage of information, managing and organizing data, and what we've seen so far is the MySQL database and any data files that we may use, view presentation for information to the user, the UI or user interface. An example of this is HTML, and then we might have minimal PHP, so a for loop that iterates over data to print it out. It is part of the view as opposed to the controller, and then a lot of our PHP files fall into the controller category. It just handles user requests and gets information from the model. Awesome. Cool. Jumping into the document object model, this just refers to the way HTML documents are organized, and they're organized into a tree structure that has a hierarchy. So if we have access to an object representation of the document, we can work with the document like we manipulate objects, basically. And to make this a little bit clearer, when we have a lot of our different tags respond to different roots in our tree. And then for this example, we have the starting document node. We have then our HTML node that splits into head and body. Head has title, and then title contains hello world. And our body just contains hello world as well. Okay, awesome. So any questions on any of the things that we covered so far? And if not, Hannah will take over with JavaScript.
Okay,
awesome.
Cool.
Okay.
If anything comes up with PHP or HTML or any of the stuff Maria covered, we can always pause. We're doing better on time again. So awesome. Cool. And just to go back really quickly to this, if you look at every past year's exam, this comes up either, here's some HTML, make this diagram, or here's this diagram, make some HTML. So definitely practice that, and then that's one guaranteed question that you can get right. Cool. So let's talk about JavaScript and how it's a little bit different from languages like PHP and C, the two languages we saw beforehand. So number one, it's loosely typed. That is like PHP, but unlike C. It's an interpretive language, again, that's like PHP, unlike C. And this is going to allow us to use it works really nicely with web pages. It's going to allow us to manipulate the content and how it looks and what it does. We're going to see a little bit of AJAX. It allows us to communicate asynchronously with different servers and get information. And this is the thing that really separates JavaScript from PHP and C, is that it is client-side. Both PHP and C are typically server-side, and for the most part, and almost entirely what we've seen at least in this class, JavaScript acts on client-side, which means that the browser is actually responsible for running it. And that means that we don't need to interact with the server. So it means it could be a lot faster, because it's actually just like it's Chrome, it's Safari, it's Firefox, whatever you use, actually running your JavaScript. Cool?
What does asynchronously mean?
What does asynchronously mean? Great question. Asynchronously means, the context in which we use it is, okay, we are creating a web page, and we need to get some information. So with the example of Mashup, some information that we might want is article titles. Now, one option is to do it synchronously, and that means let's stop, go get the article, get the article back, and then render. But that would be really slow. That would be a bad user experience, because you would just be sitting there waiting for something to respond. Asynchronously means we'll continue going about our business, rendering the page, and we'll send off a request that's kind of going to happen in the background. I think we use the example in lecture of like calling Rob and saying, hey, can you look this up for me and get back to me, as opposed to just me waiting on the phone? So asynchronously means it happens kind of in the background, away from us, in parallel. Yeah, great question. Anything else? Great. And we'll jump a lot more into asynchronous requests with AJAX.
Where does it fall with model view controller?
Great question. Where does JavaScript fall with model view controller? I guess it can fall, so it's we don't usually like squish it into that paradigm, but I guess I would say, okay, so JavaScript actually is going to allow us to gather data, interpret data, like actually do meaningful things with the data, and that way it's very control-like, but it's also going to allow us to like display things and print things, and in that way it's very model-like, or sorry, very view-like. Yeah, so it's kind of like PHP and where it can kind of go, be both. Yeah, good question. Anything else? All right, awesome, moving right along. Okay, so let's see an example of how we can use JavaScript in one of our web programs. So consider this index.html with a bunch of HTML, and the thing I want you to focus on is this script tag. And this says, okay, I want to run some JavaScript, and here's where it lives. It lives in hello.js. And very much like CSS, we could put JavaScript within the HTML. Why might we want to separate it out? Yeah? Yeah, it's easier to use across different web pages, it keeps things cleaner, it's just good practice. Awesome, good answer. So this is going to be our index.html, and then down here is our tiny little JavaScript file. And all it says is alert, hello world. So what happens is when this page renders, so if you go to whatever website this is, all that's gonna happen is it's gonna say, okay, I'm going to run this JavaScript code, and this JavaScript code just says, alert, hello world. So I'm going to get this friendly little pop-up. Cool? That's kind of like our very first JavaScript program, our hello world. Cool. All right, so let's look a little bit more about what the syntax of JavaScript looks like. And specifically, let's compare it to C and PHP, which we've seen before. In JavaScript, we're going to have var, the name of the variable, and then its actual value. And we don't specify a type. Just like in PHP, but very unlike in C. So for example, if we wanted to store the value 50, in C we would have to say, hey C, I want an integer, I'm gonna call it I, and its value is 50. In PHP it's a little bit easier, we say, hey, I want a variable called I, and its value is 50. Very similarly, in JavaScript, we say, hey, I want a variable called I, its value is 50. Every subsequent time that I use I, I don't need to write var, it's just I. From that point on. In the same way in C, where once we say int I, we just use I. Cool? All right. Moving on to loops. Luckily, these almost looked exactly the same as what loops are going to look like in something like C, where your for loop is going to have three parts, an initialization, a condition, and an update. A while loop, it looks the exact same. We just give it a condition, and a do while loop, again, exactly the same. We give it a condition. Let's say I wanted to iterate over I wanted to do something five times. In C, we might write for int I equals 0, I is less than 5, I plus plus. Only difference in JavaScript, instead of saying int I equals 0, we say var I equals 0. Beautiful. Cool. That's the only difference. Awesome. Any questions on any of that? Yes.
So in PHP, it's the same thing except with like a variable?
In PHP, it's going to be a dollar sign. So it's going to be dollar sign I equals 0, dollar sign I is less than 5, dollar sign I plus plus.
Yep.
Yeah, great question. All right, cool. Now let's talk about function declarations. In C, when we declared a function, we gave it a name and we gave it some parameters. And at the beginning, we wrote the type. In JavaScript, all we have to do is write the keyword function that says, hey, JavaScript, I'm about to define a function. In this case, it has name sum. And it takes two arguments, x and y. Notice that we don't care about the types of x and y. And just like C, we have this keyword return, so we can do something like return x and y. And now once we've written this first function, we can use sum anywhere, and that's totally fine. One really cool thing about JavaScript that is very unlike C is that functions can be treated like values. So we can do something like here, where suppose I covered this up. I covered up the var sum part. And we just said function xy equals return x plus y. That is what would be called an anonymous function. It's a function without a name. Whereas this says function sum, blah, 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 this would just say function. Okay? But now, even though I have this anonymous function, that function is really just a value. We can treat it like a value. So we can save it in a variable the same way we could store 50 in a variable. So we can say, okay, I want a variable. It's called sum, and it is this function. So these two things are actually going to do the exact same thing, but the syntax is a little different, and kind of a fun note. Yeah?
So could you call this function anonymous by saying like sum brackets 2
Yeah, you can call this anonymous function in the same way. You would do sum parentheses 2 comma 5 parentheses semicolon. That would be totally fine. If I didn't do var sum equals function, if I just deleted this, I know it's on my hand, but pretend I deleted this, then that function is kind of just gone. You can never use it again because you don't have a name for it. It's hard to refer to something you don't know what to call. Cool. Good question. Yeah.
And can you reference sum in other places with the value x plus y?
Can you reference sum in other places with the value x plus y? I'm not entirely sure what you mean.
So you're past, like, this anonymous function is sum is equal to this anonymous function.
Mm-hmm.
So sum is now a variable that you can...
Right. So sum is a variable, but it's actually so sum is a variable whose value is the function. So it is a function, which is like kind of a weird thing to wrap your head around since we've been playing with C and you can't do that in C. But now we can call sum the same way we could call sum here.
Okay.
Yeah. Good question. Okay. Yeah.
So we don't need to use prototypes in PHP or JavaScript?
No, we don't need to use prototypes in especially in JavaScript. So like one kind of bad practice thing that I'm going to say that you shouldn't do is you don't have to write var I equals 50. You could just start doing I equals 50. And that would just make I a global variable. It's very bad practice to never say explicitly var I, but it's something you can do. The interpreter's not going to yell at you. JavaScript is pretty, like, you can do what you want. Yeah. Oh, sorry, there's two. Look, in the orange pants. Good.
No, I was just saying I didn't want to hang up.
Yeah, so these two essentially do the same thing.
And what's the advantage of using one over the other?
No advantage of using one over the other. It's just, I just wanted to kind of show you two different pieces of syntax. A lot of times where anonymous functions do have a purpose is if the argument to another function should be a function, and we'll see that in just a second with Ajax. So if that didn't make any sense, store it in the back of your head. That's where an anonymous function might be useful because it's not really worth giving it a name since we're just going to use it once.
X and Y change later on, will sum change as well?
If X and Y change later on, will sum change as well? So this is actually, I think something that's, like, again, it, like, just feels very different from C. This isn't a value. It's not, like, 5. It's just the function itself. So as soon as you give it parameters, then it'll actually calculate a value.
And then you can call the function and use it to get some value.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could just do var sum equals sum of two values. Yeah. Cool. Any other questions? Yeah?
But would that confuse sum and sum? Like if you had a variable sum, would you call the function sum?
If you did something like sum equals sum 2, 5,
yeah.
That would, I believe that would overwrite the value of sum.
Yeah.
So another interesting thing about JavaScript is that a single variable can take on a bunch of different types. Bad practice, you shouldn't do something like what you just said. But in C, if I is set equal to an integer, we know that it's never going to become a string. This is not the case in JavaScript. Yeah, good question. Anything else? All right, doing all right on time. Keeping going. All right, so if we look at an array in JavaScript, here's a quick example of an array of strings. And arrays can grow dynamically. They don't have a fixed size the same way that they do in C. We can access elements with just the square brackets. That looks a lot like PHP and a lot like C, where we can say, in this case, if I wanted the word JavaScript, I would do ARR square brackets with a 0, 1, 2. Cool. And then if you remember in C, when we wanted to get the length of an array, it was really annoying. But in JavaScript, super easy. All we do, dot length. Gives it the lengths. That's it. Yeah, it makes your life a lot easier. Cool? All right. Okay, objects. Not fair. Objects in JavaScript feel a lot like structs in C's and associative arrays in PHP. So what we've seen a lot of is JSON, which stands for JavaScript Object Notation. And it's basically a way of structuring our data. So let's see an example. It's probably the easiest. So here's an example of an object that stores the class CS50. And when I say class, I mean course, not like, yeah, the course CS50. And you'll see that everything in the object is going to be contained in curly braces. And we kind of start to associate field names or keys with the different values. So you can start to see how this kind of feels like an associative array in PHP. So we're going to associate the field or the key name course with the string CS50. We're going to have an instructor. We're going to have TFs. We're going to have number of PSETs. And we're going to have recorded. Okay. And one cool thing to note is all of these things have different types. And that's totally fine. It's fine for an object, in fact, it's probably expected for an object, to have a combination of strings and numbers and booleans and arrays and whatever else you might want to have inside your object. And note that these are going to be the names or the keys, and then we just set it equal with a little colon. Yeah.
What exactly does JSON mean?
JSON just stands for JavaScript Object Notation, and it's just a way of formatting. Yeah. It's a way of formatting our data. In C, it's structs. In PHP, it's associative arrays. In JavaScript, we have objects.
So CS50 is our object?
CS50 is the object in this case. Yeah. Cool. All right. Now, how do we actually access those fields or change those fields? For example, suppose we decided that you wanted one fewer PSET this semester. Instead of 9, we're just going to have 8. How would we change that? There are two ways that we can do that. Number one is with the dot notation, and number two is with the square bracket notation. So for example, if I wanted to change or access the PSETs field in our CS50 object, what I would do is CS50.PSETs. So the name of the object dot the name of the field or the key. Very similarly, if I could, it is exactly equivalent to do CS50 and then in bracket, in square braces, PSETs. Cool? Yeah?
Is JSON technically JavaScript still, even though like in the PSETs we separated out and used it?
Sure, so the question is JavaScript, are JavaScript and JSON equivalent? So JSON is notation, basically the way that we write out an object from JavaScript. So they're not exactly the same. I would say JavaScript, there are objects in JavaScript. JSON takes those objects and prints them in, displays them, or stores them in a nice way. Yeah, so JSON isn't a programming language the way that JavaScript is. It's just a notation for our objects in JavaScript. Cool, yeah?
So what exactly are you doing in that slide and autocomplete?
Sure, so this actually does nothing. Let's say this is just a way to access. So let's say we wanted to change the number of problem sets from 9 to 8. What we would do is do something like CS50.PSETs equals 8, semicolon. Yeah, great question. This is just kind of to show you syntax. Doesn't actually do anything useful. Cool. Any questions? All right, cool. Moving right along. So let's look at a quick example of how JavaScript works. Because I told you it does all these cool things and allows us to modify web pages. Let's actually see it in action. So take, for example, this HTML file. And the thing I want you to focus on is this particular tag, which is a button with ID search button. And it's just on the page. Okay? So now let's see what we can actually do. Well, suppose when you click that button, we want to make an alert. You click the button. Let's see how we can do that. So window.onload. This isn't something that you've seen in class. It's just therefore won't need to know it for the quiz. But this basically says, OK, call this function when the window loads. OK, so that's just kind of setup code. Don't worry so much about that. What I want you to focus on is in here. Okay, we say var search button equals document.getElementById search button. So as you might guess, what this does is it says, okay, go find the element with ID search button. And now we have that actual element, and I'm going to store it in the variable search button. Okay, and now we can actually use that element and change it or access its values, things like that. We can actually start to engage with the web page. So here I say, okay, now that I have that button, when it is clicked, call this anonymous function. So this is where kind of anonymous functions become useful. And what does the function do? Well, it just calls this alert function, and it says, you click the search button. So what will happen if I go to wherever this HTML lives, and I click the button, I'll get a fancy little alert that says, you click the button. So the things to focus on here, document.getElementById gets a particular HTML element with the given ID. And now we can set what should happen when that particular element is clicked.
We have to code all of that, right?
Sorry?
We have to physically code all of that.
Do we have to physically code all of that? Yes. Isn't this kind of annoying? This is a lot of code. Right, we could use something, and in particular, it's telling me I have to teach section. All right, in particular, let's use the library jQuery, because that was really long and really annoying, and I want to be able to simplify it and make it shorter and easier to write. So jQuery is a JavaScript library. So JavaScript is a programming language, jQuery is a library, okay? And it makes a bunch of things easier. It makes changing and going across a HTML document much easier. It makes handling events easier. It makes animation easier, and it makes Ajax easier. So let's jump into two of those things right now. Excuse me. Before we do, some basic syntax. This is what most calls to the JavaScript, to the jQuery library look like. We use this dollar sign, no connection to PHP, just inconvenient. The name of a selector, dot, and then an action. So let's see some concrete examples of that. So this actually is the same code from the event slide. So this long, ugly thing becomes this much nicer, smaller thing. So let's try to break this down. This says, OK, jQuery, this dollar sign, jQuery, find me the window. So that's the selector. When it loads, call this function. So that's everything inside. OK, so far so good? All right. Now, jQuery, find me the thing with ID, search button, and when it is clicked, call this function. And then this function's exactly the same, just do a little bit of alert, you click the search button. So that's really nice. It really condenses and simplifies our code. How did I know that it's ID search button and not like class search button?
Hashtag?
Yeah, this hash symbol, it's just like CSS. So remember with CSS, when we wanted to select something by ID, we use the pound sign. And when we wanted to select something by class, we use the dot. Great. Make sense? So jQuery is supposed to just make our life easier. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm a little confused as to like how the anonymous function works. So
sure.
Did you name this anonymous function or how is it just called?
Sure. So function is just a keyword that says, I'm about to define a function. Okay, and then we pass it as an argument to, let's take this inner one, to the click function. So that function, this anonymous function, becomes an actual argument. So remember in JavaScript we can treat functions as values.
Okay.
Yeah, I like that O. Nice. Other questions?
Good.
Awesome. Some quick useful jQuery. I'm not going to go through all of these. These slides will be up online a little bit later, so you can check it out a little bit later. But basically, the general pattern holds, where we say, okay, hey jQuery, here's my selector, and then here's an action. And you can do things like access the value of a form, access some HTML, control what happens when the user submits a form, things like that. Yes.
So how, given that we can't copy and paste the entire jQuery documentation onto our cheat sheet, where's the line drawn? Like, how much jQuery do you need to know?
Great question. The question is essentially like, given that you can't access the jQuery documentation during the test, how much should you know? We would not expect you to like come up with some random function that we would expect you to Google. Things that are fair game are, I would say, like, just kind of the general syntax, being able to select by ID and by class, so just like CSS. And then the actual functions themselves will likely tell you. Yeah?
So when you select by class would be dot.
Yes, exactly. Good. When you select by class, it's going to be dot instead of the pound sign. Yes?
Can you look at the difference between selecting by ID and by class?
Sure. The difference between selecting by ID and selecting by class. So as Maria said a little bit earlier, there can only be one HTML element with a given ID. Whereas class, it allows us to group a bunch of different elements together. So things that are related, but not exactly the same. Cool, does that answer the question? Awesome. Yes? What happens if you have multiple things that are the same class? So for example, if we're just using pure JavaScript, we would do something like document.getElements by class. And then what that actually does is returns an array of elements, and you have to like either iterate over them or find which one you want. It's not going to give you a single element. It's going to give you an array of elements. Great question. Anything else? Awesome. Okay. Yeah, so I think if you're familiar with any jQuery you saw in the PSET, you should be good to go.
Yeah.
Question? Oh, no. I really have to teach. Relax. It'll be fine. I'll get there. Okay. Cool? All right. Let's talk about Ajax. All right. So Ajax is going to be let's start with what it stands for. It's an acronym. It stands for Asynchronous JavaScript and HTML and XML. And XML is basically like is going to be the type of our data, but we haven't actually used XML. Instead, we just use JSON. So basically, it's some data. Asynchronous JavaScript and data, in this case, JSON. And our goal, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, is to be able to make a request, have that request do its thing in the background, but continue to do whatever we were intending to do. And then when that information is ready, then we'll incorporate it. Okay? So let's see what this actually looks like. And this you should be a little bit familiar with from PSET 8, the one you just turned in. So here's a valid jQuery function that we might want to know about. This $, so it says jQuery function get JSON. And what this function does is it takes a URL and some parameters. So I think in the case of PSET 8, it was like the URL was articles.php and the parameters was geo equals some postal code. And it says, okay, make a request to this URL with the given parameters. And that just happens, all right? When it finishes, it's either going to successfully complete or it's going to fail. So this is the equivalent of call Rob and ask him to do something. And then when he calls back, he's either going to say, I'm done or I failed. Okay? So in the case where you're done, you say, okay, I'm done, and then you call this function. In this case, it's going to be a function that takes some information. The one we usually care about is data, the data that we were actually returned as a result of calling getJSON. And you can do something with it. So in the case of PSET 8, we displayed it as a list. All right, fail is going to be a function that is called if the request fails for whatever reason. And in the case of PSET 8, we just console.log it. Cool. Any questions on that? Yeah?
Can we just use function data instead of function comma text status comma jQuery?
Sure. So I think in the PSET we just saw function data. So it's just the... Yes. Okay. That's what we saw in the PSET. That's totally fine. These are just like if you wanted to pull out more information, these are the things that you could get from getJSON. Good question. Anything else? Yeah.
The getJSON is Ajax.
Okay, so this is the kind of tricky part. It is a jQuery function that allows you to do asynchronous calls. And those asynchronous calls, that's what we've been referring to as Ajax. Yeah. That took me a really long time to pull apart when I was a student.
Cool.
Yeah, can I say that again? This getJSON function, it is a jQuery function. And it's going to make an asynchronous call. And these asynchronous calls, we've been referring to those as Ajax. Cool. All right, any other questions? All right, we have just a couple minutes left, and Maria is going to wrap up with security, and then we're going to be just about done. Awesome.
Awesome, okay. So this is, just take like a couple of seconds to look over this, and this is not something really great. And can someone tell me why this, what is going on in foo and in main could potentially result in something bad and what that's called? Yep.
If the argument passed in is more than 12 characters.
Right, perfect. So what is it called? You just mentioned
buffer
it.
Overflow.
Yep, buffer overflow. So this is something that we refer to as buffer overflow. And we see that Inside of foo, we've defined our buffer C with a size of 12. However, in main, we don't check in any way at all whether the argv1, so that's the second argument, we don't check whether the size of it is appropriate. So if we had an especially like malicious like user who put in some argument that was longer than 12 and then potentially beyond the bounds of that argument had some executable code that he was trying to do something bad with it, then this, what would happen, would override the return address of the foo function, causing the function to, when returning, to execute that code, and then like bad things could happen. So does this make sense to everyone? And how can we protect against this? Any suggestions? Basically, inside of potentially foo, how can we check to make sure that that can't happen? Okay, suggestion is allocate additional memory of the size exceeded. Actually, we can do something a lot simpler than that as well. We can just get the string length of the argument that is entered, check if that is less than or equal to 12, which is what we want it to be because we don't want it to exceed the bounds of our buffer. And then if it doesn't, we can work with the argument. And then if it does, we actually want to yell potentially at the user. But this is how we would do that. Yes? Oh, sorry, yes. Memcopy takes whatever Memcopy takes whatever is in bar, whatever is like passed onto foo as the command line argument. So it's going to take argv1. Argv1 is called bar here. So it's going to take bar, and it's going to copy it into C.
Okay.
And it's going to copy this. The third argument just refers to how much it's going to copy into C. Yeah, it's copying all of it. Yep. Yeah, so first we make sure the bar is not equal to null because it's a pointer. Then we get the string length of bar. We make sure that it's less than or equal to 12. And then because we've made sure, we can actually memcopy and be sure that that's OK. Awesome. OK. Any questions? Great. OK. So. I have two true or false questions. Can anyone tell me right away if these are true or false? Yes, it's false. Exactly, both of them are false. So using single password is never really a good idea because if someone knows your password, they can just like access all your other accounts, and then like icons do nothing to ensure security. We should usually look for HTTPS instead of HTTP in the URL. And some other types of attacks that we've mentioned and that David has mentioned in lectures, SQL injection attacks. We already saw that if we don't see the CS50 query function makes sure that the SQL injection attacks cannot occur. But if we weren't using CS50 :: query, we would have to make sure that the user input isn't actually some SQL query that would cause all our tables to be dropped or like something bad to happen with our database. Session hijacking is another type of attack that happens when some bad person uses some victim's session ID to access the login information. So like a very trivial example of that is like if we have like a public computer, then bad person logs in and then they have cookies that are saved and cookies do not change for a session. Then we have the victim go in and then log into the website. The cookies don't change for a certain session. And then the victim logs into the website and then leaves. And then the person who go backs can still then use their session ID to access their information. So that's one example of how that could happen. And then I wouldn't worry too much about like specific like code or anything like that that could cause this, but having some sort of idea what the variables involved in this are. And then manipulating header data is another type of attack that David has talked about, and it just refers to what can happen when the response, the HTTP response inside of our header is not sanitized properly, and any of the fields. For example, if someone overwrites one of the header values to contain anything more than what they should contain and actually contain, for example, a 200 OK status code, then they could potentially do malicious things when they're not supposed to. But I wouldn't worry too much about the specific like code that could cause this, just sort of understanding like high-level things like that. And I think this is all that we have to cover. Amazing. Anyone have any questions on any of the things that we covered? Yes.
So one sort of more logistical question. Is the content mainly focused for things after quiz one?
So question is the content focused mainly on quiz, on things after quiz one? So the focus is on after quiz one, with the exception that we need to focus on things in PSET 5 and a lot of the data structures that we covered. And we can't say that we can ignore anything before that because it builds like upon it as well. So focus on that plus PSET 5 material, like including linked lists, stacks, queues, and everything that Hannah went over.
Right. Yeah, we went over all of the C stuff at the very beginning very quickly. But make sure to review that. Go back and watch like the PSET, or sorry, the Quiz Zero review. A couple more logistical notes, just while we have your attention. We are going to have office hours both on Monday and Tuesday night. They're going to be in MD 119. This is all on the website, so if you don't hear, no worries.
8:30 to 11?
Yeah, 8:30 to 11. We'll be there. We'll be there to answer questions. It's like pretty chill and fun. You guys can ask any questions that you have on Quiz 1. And Quiz 1 is on Wednesday. So good luck. If you have any questions, maybe come talk to us up here one-on-one. Cool. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, guys.